Thank you. So I'm Pippa Hawley. I've come from Vancouver, BC, and I'd really like to thank everybody for making me welcome here. I'm actually not an oncologist. I'm a general internal medicine specialist, and I've been practicing as a palliative medicine specialist in Vancouver for the last 20 years or so. I'm actually the first palliative medicine subspecialist in BC by virtue of being on the exam board, which was a sneaky way of not having to do the exam. We've just created the subspecialty in Canada. So our first residents are just coming through their second year. So I likewise don't have any financial relationships or commercial interests, and I would like to thank Alexandra Eason and one of her residents, Erin Sadler, who invited me to collaborate with them on a paper, which I think kind of led to me being invited to join you for this. So I didn't actually know what my colleagues were going to present before I made my slides, so I apologize if there is a little bit of repetition, but there are a couple of points which I think do warrant some repeat. There are some really good, there's good data about what the benefits of specialist palliative care are when integrated into a variety of contexts, oncology being the one that really kind of started it with Jennifer Temel's study, which I'm not going to present. I'm sure you've all heard it till you're sick of it. But there have been lots of other studies and other contexts which also show the benefits. So there's no point me going through a great long list of studies trying to justify the benefits of specialist palliative care. That's done and dusted. Just accept it. At multiple studies, multiple meta-analyses, and systematic reviews—they all say the same thing. So that boat has sailed. So the question is how you actually operationalize that. And in surgery, we know that that surgical patients in general tend to do more poorly than those in medical programs in terms of integration of palliative care into their disease management. Even within oncology, there are variations. Like hematology patients tend to do much more poorly. We know that late or no referral, which is quite common, is associated with poorer outcomes for everybody, not just the patients, their caregivers, but healthcare budgets and ourselves as well. You've already heard information about the symptom control, survival, quality of life. But I would like to go down to the bottom. And that point about caregiver burnout, particularly the professional caregiver, is really important. And if you talk to physicians who are burning out, one of the most contributory factors is the stress related to this fear of failure and not being able to live with witnessing suffering and feeling helpless and not being able to relieve it. You can witness suffering and relieve it, and that can be one of the most satisfying things and actually builds resilience. But failure to address suffering and feeling of a failure is a really big cause for people to start drinking, doing other, comforting lifestyle choices which are not in anyone's best interest and eventually some burning out. So we've talked already about what palliative approach to care provides, but this is the one bit that I think does warrant some repetition. We talked about prevention and management of symptoms, particularly prevention being really important, communication, goals of care, support with advanced care planning. But note that none of these actually require a specialist. There's nothing here that a surgeon is disqualified from providing. And there are never going to be enough palliative care specialists for you to say, well, we practice integrated palliative care because we do a palliative care referral on all our patients. What I really liked, particularly with one of my colleagues' talk here, is that everybody gets the palliative approach to care. If they're in an ICU, they're there because otherwise they would die. So this, by definition, they have a risk of dying. So it's just taken as given that everybody has palliative care needs and they're elicited early and addressed early, which is really the way that I really applaud and hope that that people will take going forward. I looked to see if there was any recent data to see if this message that has been delivered fairly consistently over the last 10 to 20 years, actually, has actually been received and operationalized in surgical training programs, particularly in the US. And this was a study that was just published this year. Not a huge study, but it didn't have a huge response rate, but it was current. And it was amongst, like, you guys, members of a big society in the US. And it showed that there was really a paucity of formal training in palliative care. We actually have not had a surgical trainee come to our palliative care training program in BC yet. We had one guy do an elective. and I get to do one talk in surgical foundations in year one. That's it for their surgical training, unless they get some role modeling from the surgeons. But there's certainly no more involvement of a palliative care specialist in their training, which I think is woefully inadequate. And I'm sure UBC is no worse than many other programs. They get inadequate training in techniques to forego life-sustaining measures. So it's all very well to say we're going to focus on comfort care, but how do you actually do that, and how do you communicate to your patients and their families? And also, a lot of surgeons cited the unrealistic expectations about cure, and that point that Herb made about when you're here, you tell the patients you've got an 87% chance of dying, people here the 13% chance of living. So this whole thing about communication is really important. When they looked at it a little bit further, just drilling down to the details in the comments for the study, surgeon knowledge and training, specific communication challenges, difficulty prognostication, expectations, these are all raised. But there's also systematic issues regarding the culture, lack of documentation and lack of appropriate resources. So what I've tried to do is come to you with some tool that might be helpful to you, not around prognostication. So, if you look at the barriers to having integrated palliative care in surgical practice, what are they? Well, the knowledge and the training, first of all, you're the guys that probably don't need to be here because you're here. It's the ones that didn't come are the ones that are going to be the tough ones to engage. So I want you to be our ambassadors, and that I want you to take away the responsibility for trying to change the culture in amongst your peers in your own institutions. The communication challenges, at the end of the day, it's all because nobody wants to talk about dying. Okay, but if you start talking about palliative care and serious illness without actually talking about dying, that actually makes it much easier. You can at least get started. And are any of you familiar with the Serious Illness Conversation Guide that Atul Gawande and his group Adobe Labs have developed? It's a huge thing in Canada right now. Like, everybody's talking about it, all the students, all the nurses, everybody's being trained to have serious illness conversation guides using this thing. And it doesn't have the word palliative written anywhere on it, which is really good. So if you take out the whole death bit and talk about palliative care needs, then you can get into it without this feeling of having to get over that hump. And then the other thing about prognostication, there's been an enormous focus on prognostication, and even with the surprise question. But in reality, like, if there's a 0.1% chance of dying, then we should be doing this. So whether it's 50%, whether it's 87%, whether it's 2%, is really pretty irrelevant. Because even if there's that very small percentage chance of dying, and it's the context was presented as a really positive one, well, yes, everything's fine, the chances are they're going to get better, and then the patient dies, and the family just feel completely overwhelmed and blindsided. They just did not see it coming. Whereas if you can say there is a possibility that your loved one might die, but there is a good possibility that they might not, and let's talk about both without talking about any numbers, that can really be helpful. So, talking about the expectations, what if expectations of survival or not survival are actually irrelevant to the discussion? So I'm going to be talking to you about a model, and Herb actually has, I think, handed some of the little cards out with some pictures of the model, but I'll get to. But if you can just think about the way that we're going to be able to change the way care is delivered, cultural change really doesn't happen overnight, and we need to have lots of different people involved and repeated conversations. It's very hard to change deeply held misconceptions. And employing the need to know technique is a really good way of engaging your colleagues. So if someone comes to you and they're stressed, they're distressed because of a difficult patient family situation, that is your opportunity. That's your open door to be able to go in and say, have you thought about maybe talking about it this way, or have you explained, or have you shown them this? Talking with administrators, if you need support, you need funding, you need more support for your social worker on your ward, or to have a better palliative care consult service, so you have got somebody to phone at 2 a.m, even if it's just a telephone discussion. These are the sorts of things that you can engage the administrator saying, if you do this, it will save you this much money. It's a really good way to make sure you get resources. And use communication tools that are at your disposal. And this is where I'm getting into the bow tie model. So you're probably wondering if I'm ever going to get there. So a picture can say 1,000 words. I always like this one because I think it gives it, it's always the medical people really get this. Okay. So the old model, which was presented, you know, with the arbitrary point where someone hits that black line and all of a sudden they're not curable anymore. And you know, then we have to start having the conversation. You know, that we know hasn't worked very well for a long time. The CHPC model is actually from the year 2000. This is a long time ago, 18 years ago now, since we've had this integrated care model. But it's had a really slow rate of uptake. I saw this as in the abstract book from ASCO in 2010, as I don't think there's been much in there since then about models. But this is significantly later, 10 years later, and it's still a proposed model. And I'd say that even now, that's the proposed model is still very much out of date. Because this is what we see. If we look at this model and we think everything in the garden is lovely, you know, people get therapy to modify the disease and it all works really well most of the time and then sometimes it doesn't, but then they have hospice, which is wonderful. And then people are going to have a lovely death and everything is going to be just fine afterwards. But this is what our patients see. It doesn't look like that at all in real life. They want the cure, you know, I'm going to get my Whipples or whatever, I'm going to get my my new immune therapy and I'm going to beat this cancer, you know, the right to conquer cancer. I'm going to beat it. I'm not going to give in. And then hospice is kind of, well, where they put you to die. Everybody's given up. You might just as well, you know, give up on me. And the only way out of this model is in a box. So the idea with the bow tie model is actually just to try and give you a visual representation of what we've been talking about. Because some people don't hear the words or they don't understand the words. You have to actually show them something visually. So with this bow tie model, the focus is very much on survivorship being one option, but hospice being another option, and they're both equally placed there. So the key thing, if somebody is really one of those people that's focusing on the 13% chance of survival, you can enter the conversation and say, this is what this plan of care may look like, and survivorship is definitely there. Let's see what that looks like and what happens on the way. And the model is intended for contextual editing. This is not, it's the sort of the thing you can do on the back of a napkin. You can write it on a paper towel. You can write it on your hand, you know, write it on any old scrap of paper, but fill in all the little blanks there, depending on what the particular context of your situation is. So in the oncology context, you might be starting off with surgery, but you might also be having radiotherapy, chemotherapy, you might have hormone therapy, could be a clinical trial. There's a whole load of things that could be happening. Somebody with COPD would have a very different picture. Somebody diagnosed with chronic renal failure would have a very different picture. Somebody with heart failure who may or may not get a heart transplant or a VAD. You know, the picture is going to look very similar, but the concept of disease management, where you're attempting to either cure or at least control the disease, with your main focus at the beginning from the time of diagnosis, with gradually increasing focus on either transition to survivorship or transition to end-of-life care, is the sort of the trajectory that you can use to sort of provide a map for patients. So if somebody's diagnosed, you go and see them before their operation, say, this is what we think is wrong with you. We're going to do this operation and we hope we're going to be able to cure it, but this is what it's going to look like. And over time, we'll figure out whether this is going to be something you survive or whether you don't, and this is what your survivorship might look like. Having done that at the beginning, you can then revisit it later on. You can say, remember, we looked at this model. Well, things have been going pretty well, actually. We think that at this point, we think we've got it all, or you seem to be doing really well. Let's focus now on your rehabilitation. You know, you're not going to bounce right back to the same health that you were in before, most likely. So what can we do to start improving your chances of functional recovery? So let's talk about physiotherapy, let's talk about nutrition, et cetera, et cetera. Or it could be the other way around, that, you know, we really tried our best and, you know, we thought that things were going well, but unfortunately those, you know, little cells, the metastases that we thought we caught with our axillary node dissection, unfortunately must have traveled further, and the chemotherapy is not going to cure them. We can still give you treatment, which may help you live longer and feel better, but we're not going to be able to cure you. So let's talk about what that might look like. And remember, there's no scale on the bottom, so it could go on for, you know, for years. I've got people I'm seeing now that I met 17, 18 years ago with metastatic breast cancer at the time, and they're still going strong. In fact, some of them look better than they did when I first met them. And we can never be certain about what will happen. I have another patient who got into our POG study, the personalized oncogenomic study. She had advanced metastatic colorectal cancer with spinal cord compression, liver, lung mets, multiple areas of lymphadenopathy in her abdomen. And within 5 weeks of starting Ibosartan, which is a blood pressure pill, her PET scan was completely negative and she was effectively disease-free. So, you know, now 3 years later, she's having problems with recurrence in a sanctuary site around the surgery in her spine. But these are sort of unexpected things that can happen. And the case that Dr. Easton and Dr. Sadler and I presented in our recent publication was a similar situation where somebody started on an immune therapy and had a Lazarus-like act from being close to death to all of a sudden being essentially free of disease and ultimately being able to go back to work. So just lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about language, and I really congratulate the panel here for using really good language. But some of the things that you may not have realized were quite subtle here. Using hospice and end-of-life care are really good terms to use when you need to introduce the concept. But separating a palliative approach to care from specialist palliative care services is something that often doesn't come across. And the palliative approach to care is sort of a global thing that is practiced by the whole healthcare system, including all the surgeons. And specialist palliative care is a different concept. It'd be nice if they had different names, but that's the way it goes. And then examples of things I've heard people say, like, he's just palliative, or is he palliative? This one's really palliative. I'm afraid you're palliative. Well, the problem is if you use palliative as a euphemism for dying, then, you know, don't be surprised when your patients don't want it. So use it in an appropriate context, always as a prefix to something else. So does this patient have palliative care needs? You might ask the nurse or you might ask your residents. Your mum's doing really well from the surgery, but I think she has some palliative care needs we might need to attend to as well. I do feel that it's important that palliative care programs don't have do not attempt resuscitation or allow natural death, whatever euphemism you use for the code status, as a designation for eligibility. I think that is another labeling thing which is a problem. And I do think that hospice and end-of-life care are very useful, as I mentioned, and should be used. Lastly, the importance of collaboration and having an opportunity to work together with people from all different disciplines is so important. And this shouldn't be seen as a sequential thing, that you have surgical care and then you get palliative care and the surgical care stops and the palliative care starts. With all illness, there's an element of dipping in and out when needed throughout the course of illness. So it's wonderful when patients who've come from surgical programs get transferred to specialist palliative care programs and the surgeon still maintains contact and comes to visit and does a transition. The patients and the families really appreciate that, so I would strongly encourage you to do it, and don't be frightened of going to a palliative care unit or going to a hospice. Your patients will really appreciate that. And if you have an opportunity to integrate socially, at case conferences, meetings, working with your palliative care colleagues, and encourage them to do the same and invite you to things, I would really, really encourage that, because I think it can only be positive. So thank you very much, and hopefully we'll have lots of time for questions.
Oh, that was really terrific. I've been trying to keep track to make questions, and all my questions get answered. It's just that good a panel. So I'd like to thank all of our panelists, and I'd like to thank Dr. Easton for putting it together. And I'd like to open the floor to questions from the audience. Dr. Fay?
Yes, thank you, Dr. McCammon. And thanks to the panel. This is great. And it is a little bit of preaching to the choir, but I think one of the things that, with all the differences in our various institutions, a point that Anna made about her institution in another session was when we protocolize this stuff, it takes a lot of the stigma away. This is how we manage patients that are high risk. And I don't think most patients are going to figure out, are going to be surprised to hear that they're high risk because of their comorbidities, because they're walking in with a walker, because they're not coming in from home, because of whatever it is. And so I think it normalizes when we say we want to bring in all the tools that we can to set you up for success. And success may not be smooth post-operative course. It may just be getting you to the right level of care. So I guess that would be, I don't know if there are other examples of that. I mean, you talked about that, Dr. Mosenthal, about we just institute, everybody gets a palliative care consult or has a goals of care conversation at X time. And I don't know if there are other examples the panel can give from your own institutions about how that's been successful.
Question for the audience. So I'm a surgical oncologist, and when I heard Dr. Holly's model, it resonated with me. I wanted to throw this question out to you. Does this model resonate with anyone in the audience? And if so, why or why not? Or what do you see as the problems with the model? Because the current model doesn't work. The line doesn't work. So as a conceptual model, does anyone have any comments? Does it work, not work? Don't like it? Is there something better?
Can I just answer this question whilst people are thinking?
I don't know if I've got the... Oh, yes, I think it's on. Yes, just whilst you're thinking about that question, because you did actually ask a question, and I wanted to respond to it about this protocolization. How many of you are familiar with the Liverpool Care Pathway? Yeah, so not very many. I'll just describe it briefly because it was a real example of how you can go really badly wrong with protocolization, and it was a huge scandal in Europe. So the Liverpool Care Pathway was a sort of set of pre-printed orders that were meant to be followed when somebody had had the decision made about them that they had a non-survivable illness. And the problem was that where it was developed in Liverpool by a very skilled team, an interdisciplinary team, with a lot of support and a lot of experience, it worked beautifully. But the problem is as soon as you scaled it up and put it into situations where the staff were not familiar with the context, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And there were people that were put on the Liverpool Care Pathway who effectively were abandoned, and any attempts at disease modification were discontinued. For example, fluids were discontinued, some essential medications were discontinued. And so some patients died, and families got cross, and hospitals got sued. And there was a huge investigation. It made the international press, and in the end, it all got shot down in flames. And it was such a shame because the intent was really well-meaning, and the initial impression appeared that it was going to be very good. So you have to be very careful to not make a protocol look like an either-or thing. You have to always maintain the palliative care approach, but you, alongside the disease management, and not make people make this choice of either-or. Hopefully people have thought of the answer to Alexandra's question now.
Yes, Dr. Berlin?
Well, I don't know if you wanted answers to Dr. Eason's question first before I answer.
I just wanted to respond to the response, which I think that's absolutely right. But I think one can establish processes that need to happen, like having a conversation. Not that there's a particular outcome that needs to happen, but that there's at least conversations and communication, however one does it, that happen at certain time points. That's
what I was gonna add. I think I'll take the first stab at answering Dr. Eason's question. I think one of the things I like about the bow tie model compared to the other model is the inclusion of survivorship as an alternative outcome and the fluidity that introduces to this model, so that having a palliative care approach really early is not forecasting doom. Mm-hmm. It's just raising, it's acknowledging that we're in a life-threatening situation that doesn't have to end in a life-ending situation, but may. And introduces these alternate pathways so that there's the opportunity to reconsider kind of mid-course and readjust. And I think I saw that both in Dr. Mosenthal's discussion of survivors of trauma and Dr. Hawley's discussion. So now, Dr. Berlin.
Yes, Anna Berlin from New York, and I do general surgery and palliative care. And just to echo that, and in response to your question, I have seen the bow tie model before, but it wasn't until sort of listening to you present it and I guess I had always thought that, oh, all they've done is just nudge that triangle a little bit, you know, change the angle of it. It's no big deal. But really having you highlight the importance of the survivorship piece on the top didn't come through for me until this session. So thank you for shedding extra light on that. My question is unrelated. And maybe it's best for Gretchen, although anybody on the panel. My question is, what do you foresee as the sort of evidence that will emerge or the sort of studies that are necessary to replicate the TEMEL findings in surgical populations? What patient populations should be, are the lowest hanging fruit? What are the outcomes that ought to be looked at for surgical patients? What sort of methodologies are going to be helpful in demonstrating the clinical outcome benefits to concurrent palliative care, specifically concurrent early palliative care for surgical patients?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that one. So for those of you who don't know, Fur Temel published a paper in the New England Journal about 5 years ago with simultaneous palliative care for patients who were diagnosed with advanced stage lung cancer. Not only did she find major improvements in changes of quality of life, meaning that people who had simultaneous palliative care had less reduction in their quality of life over time, she actually found that these patients lived longer. So this is really a sort of earth-shattering report. It's been repeated for a lot of other cancers, notably for bone marrow transplant, and their primary outcome actually was this issue about changes in quality of life and post-traumatic stress, and again, showing a pretty significant difference. They did not look at survival, and they didn't really talk about sort of any end-of-life care, and I think you might imagine why the bone marrow transplant physicians were uncomfortable with looking at those things as primary outcomes. I think all of those things are important outcomes for the benefits of palliative care. I think the symptom management is really critical. It's very hard to measure things like quality of communication. There have been multiple negative studies because the measurement is hard. And honestly, you know, as somebody who listens to a lot of doctors talking to a lot of patients, even though the content is difficult to understand, there's a lot of nice stuff happening there. They are kind, they're compassionate, they are working very, very, very hard to try and help patients understand. And so when you are getting people to rate the quality of communication, if you like your doctor, it's going to be pretty high. And it's hard to move something that measures very high. And it's also hard to measure people's understanding or their content knowledge when they don't have a counterfactual to compare it against. And so the measurement problem is challenging. I think the idea of measuring something like goal concordant care would be really nice. But at the end of the day, once you've figured out their goals and then try to see whether their care that they received is compatible with that, you've actually intervened on them. Like, using your measurement, you have assessed their goals of care. So it's a real challenge in, of measurement.
Can I just add a little bit to that?
Ahead,
just also, you know, you don't necessarily need to prove it. Like, if it's better for the patients, it's better for the caregivers, better for the family members, and it saves money, like, we don't need to waste another 15 years replicating what we already know from a very similar context. Like, don't not do it because you haven't got a study to prove it. How can it possibly be worse? You know, ideally, hopefully at some point there'll be no point doing any more studies because you won't be able to find a control group because everybody's getting the intervention, and that would be fabulous. I mean, to an extent, that's true in oncology now. Like, that we're not going to get more studies because the standard of care is integrated palliative care. So why would you have a group where you neglect them and don't give them palliative care? That would be ethically unacceptable. And I'd have to say that if you were looking for big surgical studies, I would not be ethically comfortable with having a group where they didn't get the intervention, because there's absolutely no plausibility that it wouldn't be better.
So, but I think there's a PCORI trial now, 3 institution, including Dr. Fahey, for pancreatic?
GI malignancies.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, please, sir.
I'm Dr. Cadeau from New York City. I actually practice trauma and general surgery. Great talk. I learned a lot today. My question focuses more on whether or not cultural biases play a role in the way you approach the patients when it comes time to address palliative care, number one. And do you find any difficulty in addressing those questions when it comes to the fact that you're also the individual providing the care to the patient, i.e., when we have issues about organ donation, we oftentimes involve somebody else altogether because we don't want to appear as if we've now abandoned care for the patient. So I'm just wondering for anybody on the panel, how have you addressed those issues?
Dr. Phelan, you want to take that?
So your point's well taken about being the person who is providing care, and I'm talking about in a purely clinical context now, not a scientific context. But we don't on either the trauma or the burn side make it a point to have a new provider come in, and frankly, part of that is because in the context in which we work, we have some people who are more comfortable with this, number one, and number two, other people who are just not believers, frankly. Gretchen knows exactly what I'm talking about. I've got a couple of colleagues who, man, it's tough to get them on board with this. So one of the things that we will, when the decision comes to have these conversations between either the ICU attending or the trauma attending, what seems like it has happened, if it's in the hyper-acute first 12 to 24 hours, where really the question is, are we going to the operating room? Are we doing the decompressive crani? That's the person who has a relationship, as brief as it is, still has had the relationship, and they just go ahead and take care of it. And unfortunately, the question of a cultural interaction there really doesn't enter into it. If the patient is alive long enough that now we are truly getting into the idea of getting palliative care on board, almost always in our setting, it's driven more by just the attending, whether it's ICU or trauma, who happens to be the bigger believer in the concept of palliative care rather than what the actual role is.
I think your point is such a good one. I think that at the end of the day, these decisions require a lot of trust between the patient and the doctor. And for groups that have been historically disenfranchised, that is a really hard thing. I do think many of the palliative care skills that we talked about up here actually really help to instill trust in that patient-doctor relationship. I think the attending to emotion is really important. I also think things like, tell me more about your mother. You know, what was her life like? What was valuable to her? What are the kind of things that she did also help to instill trust as well. But I think you're right that for groups for whom there have been problems with trust in the past, you need to be really attentive to the notion that these problems will play into future relationships and use those skills to try and help overcome that. You're absolutely right.
Great. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Art Cooper, New York. I rise with some trepidation because I'm a pediatric surgeon involved with ethics to a great extent, but of course not so much with palliative care. So I wanted to respond to your question earlier about the bow tie model. And I'm just speaking, just seeing this first blush. Okay. I think it's something to me that requires a bit more explanation than the previous model. The previous model, you see that nice dotted line going up, and I think that intuitively, you know, makes good sense. Whereas this, I think, you know, whether the previous model is complete or incomplete or right or wrong or what have you, I think the dotted line showing a gradual movement toward palliative care, I think is a little bit clearer than this is in terms of someone who may never have seen that model before. Having said that, I mean, I think you've got, you know, the key elements here that need to be discussed, with one exception, and that is the issue of chronic disease management. I mean, this is all becoming, you know, blended as we move forward. The implication, I think, of the bow tie is that we're talking about an acute care situation sliding into a, you know, into a palliative care situation, whereas I think, you know, we're dealing with acute care situations for sure, okay, but we're also dealing with, you know, with chronic disease management sliding gradually into palliative care. So I'm not, you know, I'm not by no means a palliative care expert, and by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that we need a little bit more you know, thought about this model and how to integrate the chronic disease management components of it. I hope it's not too controversial.
Responses?
If I can just respond to that. No, I totally accept your point. And my aim with having survivorship there is not just a theoretical construct. It's actually a place where people, there's content in that triangle. Survivorship is not just you didn't die. Survivorship has things in it. And the idea is that you will put whatever is appropriate for that particular patient into there. And I try to use the example of COPD. You know, maybe they'll get a lung transplant. You know, there are things there where you, though it's a chronic illness, there are things which can really make a difference. Bone marrow transplants, there's a whole variety of different things. And this is not meant to be a sort of a fixed thing. It's meant to be something which is adaptable to multiple contexts, but just getting across the concept that you might die, but you might get better. And I think your request for explanation is really great. That's one of the reasons why I'm here, to try and explain it a bit better. The problem is when people just look at the diagram and don't go to the original source, the actual publication I did on it, which contains all this explanation, it's sort of taken a little bit out of context. So I'd really encourage you to look back at the original source. It was in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. But there's also a very good article that the Canadian Virtual Hospice helped me write, and that's the Canadian Virtual Hospice is the biggest hospice website in the world. It gets the most traffic of any palliative care website, and it has some fabulous resources, and there's a great little article which expands on it and puts it detail into the different contexts.